Rural Home in Shakora. Go ahead, give them a call. Do it today while you're thinking about it.
Well, some showers and thunderstorms are likely today, tonight as well. Tomorrow, we'll have a nice day with a lot of sunshine and a high near 74. Saturday and Sunday, though, again, some wet weather. So the thunderstorms or showers are not expected to be as severe as what we've seen in the past couple of days, but still, more wet weather to come. 70 for a high today, 55 for a low tonight, 70 right now in downtown Butler. I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Tier Bank studios. Next Tier Bank, your hometown community bank. Dave Mularkey's up next with It's Your Turn. Thanks for joining us and have a good day.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Mularkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mularkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Thursday already edition of It's Your Turn. Boy, we have a great show for you today. We're going to be talking a little bit of local history, and we're also going to be talking about safe boating with the summer season upon us now. That'll be a little bit later. We'll be chatting with Ray Nagy from the United States Coast Guard Auxiliary, Division 7 of the Coast Guard Auxiliary. But our first guest joins us by telephone today, and he's a man that we've chatted with in the past, Jason Cherry, but he has a new book out. Jason is a local historian and author, and the new book is called Pittsburgh's Lost Outpost, Captain Trent's Fort. First of all, Jason, welcome. Nice to have you with us again. Nice to talk to you, my friend.
Yeah, thanks for having me in.
I must tell you that, you know, if someone had asked me about the history of Pittsburgh, I would have known, okay, the French, you know, they had the Fort Duquesne there at the forks of the Ohio. And then later the British came in and ousted them, and they, you know, renamed it Pittsburgh, Fort Pitt. I did not know that there was a fort, or at least the beginnings of a fort, prior to Fort Duquesne, and that's what you talk about in your new book, right?
Yeah, it's like I said, the reason why I've, you know, decided to write this book was basically it's not much was known. I mean, there's a few accounts out there. I mean, you know, you could probably count in your hand the number of accounts that were, you know, of this certain event. And yeah, everybody seems to, it gets overlooked because we know about the, like we said, the French Fort Duquesne, and that was built and was stood for 4 years, and then eventually Fort Pitt that stood almost till the end of, you know, the Revolution. But yeah, it's a little known event because really nothing, there was a significance of it, but there was no significant battle or anything. But it was definitely in the, as I sort of put it, as the humble beginnings of eventually would lead to the city of Pittsburgh.
Well, obviously we remember Fort Pitt since it's still called Pittsburgh today. Duquesne, of course, a very common name. There's a university. There was a beer. I don't think there's a Duquesne beer anymore. But William Trent, Captain William Trent, I must confess to you, Jason Cherry, until I got your book, I got a review copy of your book here, I had never heard the man's name. Is it just me, or is he so little known?
Well, you know, and it's, like I said, Trent sort of falls between the cracks as well, I think, compared to, it's funny because he, at the same time that he's, you know, been trusted then by the governor here in basically the winter of, the early winter of 1754, January there, that, when this is all coming into the plans or the works by the governor of Virginia, Robert Dinwiddie, it's two men that basically, you know, that he thinks of first. And one is William Trent, mainly because he was a prominent Indian trader, on the frontier, not necessarily, in western Pennsylvania, but also just in the colony of Virginia and eastern Pennsylvania, and George Washington, because, you know, George at this time is sort of a namesake now, because as this fort starts, the plans and the actual ability to send men out to hopefully start recruiting to build such a fort there in the, you know, in January of 1754, he's made a name for himself for a journey through western Pennsylvania there in the late fall of 1753. And now Dinwiddie sort of fresh in his mind with George Washington, and William Trent, believe it or not, is sort of has some notoriety. His actually more so because of his father. His father, which would have been William Trent Sr., was Supreme Court Justice in Pennsylvania and also in New Jersey, and actually came in about the late 1680s, early 1690s. He's actually on the tax list in Philadelphia in 1693, the very first one, when they actually called it Philadelphia, and did a lot of business with William Penn, and eventually would be a vestryman or work for the church there, Christ Church, the widely known historic church there in Philadelphia there on Second Street, and eventually would build a house that actually is still standing today. It's in Trenton, New Jersey, which in fact was named for this Captain William Trent's father, William Trent Sr., and it's the house still stands today, and it's actually this year is the 300th anniversary of this historic house where Trent spent a little bit of his years when he was younger.
As many times as I've read about Trenton and you know, George Washington crossing the Delaware and all that stuff, I had no idea that the name of the city of Trenton came from Trent, William Trent Sr., that would have been the father of the William Trent that,
correct,
you, that you write about. So let's talk about Jr., William Trent Jr. He was a fur trader. He was very familiar with western Pennsylvania during the 1750s, right?
Yeah, he, as early as, he's actually apprenticed under, Edward Shippen III, who actually, at one time the Shippen household, you know, we'll hear more notoriety about the Shippen name. His granddaughter was Peggy Shippen, who would eventually marry, Benedict Arnold. But Edward Shippen III was a well-known merchant in Philadelphia, and Trent, was able to learn the trade not only in, the business of, you know, mercantile business, but also the fur trade when it started to become big in the 1740s. And after he moved from Philadelphia, he started running the account books for Edward Shippen III out in Shippensburg and sometimes in the Lancaster area. And eventually, at that point, that was considered like the western, you know, side of the, you know, the three counties there of in near Philadelphia. And at that point, you know, the western expansion was the biggest thing, you know, late 1740s, early 1750s. And at that time, it was mostly just Indian traders, either French and English, and, you know, possibly some of the Indian tribes. And Trent had actually attended numerous Indian treaties. One of them, such the Treaty of Logstown in 1752, was a very, you know, monumental one, just because it was talking about the plans eventually of the English, hopefully, to build an outpost out that way of what we know today as western Pennsylvania. And William Trent would eventually, an Indian tribe, the Twightwees, weren't able to attend that treaty. And he actually traveled almost 500 miles from Logstown, where Ambridge is today, Economy area, Old Economy Village area, to, you know, the western side of Ohio, almost, to what they call, what's Piqua, Ohio now, but was called Pickawillaunee then. And he had actually traveled that far and done a journey, kept a journal that's actually in the originals, actually, at Case Western Reserve there.
Wow.
And it was a journey that was sort of similar to what Washington would do a year later of, you know, another direction, but a long journey that people would take note of, you know, reading about what he experienced. And I always said that, you know, Trent at that time, especially, not only was a trader, but also a soldier. He, believe it or not, there was a war right before the French and Indian called, sort of another sort of not well-known one called King George's War. Lasted about 4 years, from 1744 to 1748. And it still involved the English and the French, and Trent was able to join an expedition to Canada from Philadelphia and actually had a company of 100 and actually got attacked by Indians outside of Saratoga there, above Albany. And had some, you know, knew the manual of arms, knew how to drill, was a captain, was, you know, paid by the king. And basically at that time, I always say, it's funny because at that point they were on the same type of foundation, Trenton, Washington, both at that young, you know, young age. It just, it seems like George Washington had a, at the time must have had a better publicist.
Well, let's set the background for this. As you mentioned, the British were really starting to see the fur trade pick up here in what we now know as western Pennsylvania. This area, by the way, was claimed not only by the colony of Pennsylvania, but also claimed by the colony of Virginia, which is why the man you mentioned, Governor Dinwiddie, was involved in sending George Washington up here. But the French claimed it as well through the action of their early explorers, and you go all the way back to the 1600s. You know, we had Jacques Marquette and Louis Joliet and La Salle, all French explorers who claimed a tremendous amount of territory in the Mississippi watershed for France. And as the British were starting to get a whole lot of money from the fur trade, the French decided they should start fortifying this area down along the Allegheny River to solidify their claim, and they started building forts, and eventually they would build Fort Duquesne. But prior to that, the British sensed what was going on too, and that's why they, I guess they commissioned your man, William Trent, to start building a fort there, right?
Right. He, like I said, they, with the pressure they were facing, Governor Dinwiddie, being just the colony of Virginia's governor, was trying to not only get, it was hard because he was trying to lay claim to this, you know, the area of western Pennsylvania, you know, especially around the Pittsburgh area, where Pittsburgh we know today at the point. And at that time, the colonies were sort of, you know, there were 13 colonies, but not all of them were on board as far as to, if this would eventually lead to a world war, especially. So with this, the colony of Virginia was sort of on their own, but they were still facing some pressure from the King of Great Britain, who at this time, you know, was hearing about these exploits of, you know, the French claims to this, what they called the Ohio country. And at this time, the French actually acted first. I mean, you figure, in summer of 1753 there, they had built almost two forts and another French outpost by the time the English had just, you know, decided to finally commission William Trent. They had built a fort there at up in Erie, Fort Presque Isle, which, you know, Presque Isle State Park we know today, and near Waterford, Pennsylvania there, right off of French Creek and LaBeouf Creek, called Fort LaBeouf. And then they built a third, which was more of an outpost at the time because they had just taken over a trader's house named John Frazier. And using his house, they used it as a supply depot and at Venango, where Franklin, Pennsylvania is today. And eventually, it would 2 years later, it would become Fort Michault. But it was the thing that, as they started building, you know, the English, and especially Governor Dinwiddie, was feeling the pressure because at this point, they needed to act, or this whole entire Ohio country was definitely going to be French run. And so by doing so, they did commission, you know, William Trent, who Trent actually sort of acted on his own. He sort of made a bold thing because he wasn't commissioned until January 26, 1754. But before that, and even when George Washington and Christopher Gist were returning on their journey, they actually passed on January 6th, as Washington would write in his journal. They passed a group of traders, as Washington put it, heading to the forks of the Ohio. Now, they weren't actually going there, but that was their intent eventually. And passing them on January the 6th, which was almost, you know, 3 weeks before he was actually commissioned, officially to actually lead and start building an outpost. And Trent sort of wanted to get ahead of the game, especially knowing full well, you know, how far the French had come.
I was interested to read in your book, Pittsburgh's Lost Outpost, that the original site where Trent was thinking about building this outpost was not actually right at the point, but rather in the area that we now know as McKee's Rocks, on top of a hill. That's pretty incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's bizarre because my goal with this book was to sort of see these sites themselves and how they look. Now, obviously, a little bit, you know, a lot has changed since the original here almost 265 years ago. And by being at the site, I felt like I could get a feel of the presence there of what these guys experienced and what their, you know, ideas and plan and framework were to do this. And in doing so, one such place I said was McKee's Rocks, because trying to find this location was not easy. And they actually, I was able to finally find there's a marker actually to mark where the an Indian mound actually was, where they've apparently found artifacts before, and it was a close to 10,000 years old. This Indian mound stretched for a while. It is very large, very lengthy, but not necessarily would have held as far as in my plan, especially the original plans of what they were trying to do for a fort. But yeah, they had marked it originally, the site. The company that William Trent had actually worked for, called the Ohio Company, their orders were eventually, and their plans were to, you know, to build a fort here at this exact spot, which they had labeled this place Fort Hill in, with the assumption that they were hopefully going to build there. But as after meeting with the Indians there in July of 1753, Trent found out that the Indians preferred another spot, and the Indians preferred, and what they referred to was the point or the forks of the Ohio, where the, you know, where the fountain and the point lies today.
And so that's where William Trent started to build his outpost. How much did he actually get built there, Jason?
Well, you know what, and there was a, it was, as far as everything was done, it was a lot, especially, you know, contemporary people had written about it. You know, Charles Stotes had written a tremendous book about outposts of Pennsylvania and basically French Indian, in the French Indian War, but also not only French forts, but English forts. And basically, you know, had gone into detail. He called it sort of, it was sort of an embryo of a fort, as he put it. It was a, what he basically said it was, it had the framework, but not necessarily had the ideas. If you saw it, you wouldn't think it was a fort. And he had basically said it was pretty much the, a storehouse, sort of a small house for supplies or magazine for powder, surrounded by like upright sticks or palisades that were sort of a defense against anybody coming in. Now, as I was further and further digging deeper and trying to find, you know, firsthand accounts of this event, like I said, you could count in your hand the number of accounts, I was able to, you know, working with a few, especially staff at University of Michigan, were able to find a sort of a an account by William Trent that was about 10 pages. Nobody had actually ever even transcribed it, let alone known what was in it. They just knew it was dated 1757, and that was, you know, 3 years after the exact date, but they claim a lot of stuff was mentioned about what happened in spring of 1754. They knew that, but nobody had actually tried to actually, you know, write out what it was, you know, in Trent's handwriting, and I took the time to do it, and believe it or not, this book is the first actual publication of such a transcription, and in fact had numerous details that had never been seen before until now. And it, and, you know, including, you know, details about the fort, talking about that Trent even mentioned in detail, saying that not only had they built one magazine or storehouse, but they started to build a second and almost completed it, in addition to building a line of defense, putting a, what he said, a horizontal log around, almost like an entrenchment around these, you know, few buildings as it got later in the months there with, you know, rumors and reports coming that the French might be coming down the river. And then eventually adding the palisade. So it was a little bigger than that. And also it was even known that Trent even said he and the Indians actually went out and marked the fort out. In other words, they laid what they called the square. In other words, it literally, as it was said, it was a square. And according to the Ohio Company plans that were, you know, a few months before that, they wanted to, their goal was to make it like 90 feet square. So they would have probably just stepped off, being these guys were surveyors, probably had, you know, wheels and stuff like we would today, and stepped off, saw with the best, you know, the flattest area to put this on the point, and, you know, after getting rid of the timber and everything, laid out the groundwork, stepped off the square, and then started pounding in sort of stakes to sort of mark how everything would have done as they were building it. And, you know, and like I said, they weren't able to complete it after 3 or 4 months, but they at least had a lot more than what was previously known.
We're talking, for listeners who may have joined us a little bit late, we're talking with Jason Cherry, local historian and author of a brand-new book just published a couple of months ago, actually. The title is Pittsburgh's Lost Outpost, Captain Trent's Fort. And it's called The Lost Outpost because it was never finished, right? The French indeed did come down the river and ousted the construction crews there, and then they proceeded to build what became known as Fort Duquesne.
Right, yeah, and it's actually, I was able to find account later after the Trent's men were actually leaving the forks of the Ohio there on April the 18th, the next day after the actual official sort of surrender. The French did made use of it right away. They ended up tearing down the sort of the defense palisades that were surrounding. But according to a letter that was found a couple months later in the Contrecoeur papers, who was the French commandant or commander there at Fort Duquesne, and I had to do an English transcription of that because there's no actually one of it. It's actually in French. It actually, he makes reference to the handiwork and carpentry of Turenne's men building these buildings, and even saying that it's possible that they made use of the lumber, but also from what it seemed in the letter, they kept the buildings and probably used them possibly for Fort Duquesne.
Mm. We'll take a quick break. We have a little bit more time to chat with Jason Cherry here on the It's Your Turn program on WISR, and we'll pick up our conversation with him in just a moment. Be right back.
Thinking about remodeling or refinancing your home? Armco Credit Union's new HELOC combines the flexibility of a traditional home equity line of credit with the low fixed rate of a home equity loan. Lock in different amounts, rates, and terms up to 20 years under one convenient loan agreement and monthly payment without the hassle of reapplying as your borrowing needs change. It's never been easier to join. So call or visit us at one of our locations or online at armcocu.com to become a member.
Armco Credit Union is an equal housing lender and federally insured by NCUA.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome back. We're chatting with local historian, reenactor, and author Jason Cherry about his just published book, Pittsburgh's Lost Outpost. Jason, you were telling me during the break that you've actually been reenacting Captain William Trent's meanderings through western Pennsylvania. Is that right?
Yeah, we've been. My parents were, known school teachers here in Butler School District, and my dad's always been a big history buff. Had done it for, always following any type of history, Civil War, American Revolution, French and Indian, and. Sort of got us, my brother and I, both involved with the 18th century, especially when we were able to, join this group, Captain William Trent's company. And, since 1990, I believe they joined late in 1989 and brought us out. I was, 10 years old at the time in 1990. So we started there, and we've been doing it ever since. Now it's sort of a big family thing we do, not necessarily every weekend, but about 7-8 events a summer. Now my wife and two daughters do it, and my brother and sister-in-law and my little niece also does it. So, and my mom and dad still do it with us. So we, try to do as much as we can and still, tell people about what we portray, and the role William Trent played, especially in the French Indian War.
Hmm. By the way, right before the break, we were talking about, Trent's Lost Outpost. The French took it over, built Fort Duquesne. It would not stay that way for long, however, thanks to General John Forbes, right? It was his expedition that beat the French and drove them out, and then yes. It became Fort Pitt, right? Wasn't that Forbes?
Yes, yeah. And ironically, on the Forbes expedition, they were able to sort of do what General Braddock didn't do in 1755 on the failed campaign to try to take Fort Duquesne. General Forbes not only really seeked the advice of George Washington, but actually seeked the help of William Trent. And on that, Trent ended up being the chief Indian interpreter on that expedition there in 1758, and was able to, get the Indian support. And also, it was Trent who actually traveled with the Indians to discover the best path that his large army could do to get to Fort Duquesne. And it was Trent's path that he took in 1754 that pretty much that Forbes ended up taking to eventually arrive and take Fort Duquesne.
Don't you just love these names, listeners? General Braddock, General Forbes. Braddock's expedition, of course, failing to take Fort Duquesne, but we still have the community of Braddock named after him, and of course Forbes, Forbes Avenue, Forbes Field, where the Pirates used to play. Amazing local history. So what happened to William Trent after his outpost was taken over and he was driven out by the French? What happened to him later in life, Jason?
Well, unfortunately, after that, in April there of 1754, Trent sort of got, the governor sort of used him as sort of a scapegoat when it came to the blame of the French taking over the Forks of the Ohio there. And at that time, William Trent, Dinwiddie sort of blamed him, called it for negligence, for leaving the Ohio to get more supplies in order to support his men there. And unfortunately, they ended up being because the governor and Trent actually about, it was about, I don't know, 5 years later or so, in 1757, about 3 years later, it came up, there was an outstanding bill that came from this whole event. Trent realized he'd used his own funding to pay his men, pay for the supplies and everything to aid in this fort, that he never received any money from the governor, the government of Virginia, or, you know, or from Dinwiddie itself, considering he controlled that. And he eventually would sue Governor Dinwiddie for the exact bill, which was about 800 pounds when it came down to that money then, which was a considerable amount. And the trial actually, there actually became a court trial that unfortunately was sort of lost in the records. I was trying to find a little bit more about it, and there is some accounts on there. Eventually, it lasted about 3 years, and I was able to find a letter dated November 8, 1760, that George Mercer wrote to William Trent saying that all those auspicious, basically looks against your character have been now forgotten because you found some true justice by, you know, claiming a victory over Dinwiddie. In other words, winning the court case. Now, whether or not he, in fact, it actually says in the letter that, and in another account, that George Washington actually came to Trent's aid as sort of a character witness. Yeah. You know, was able to at least do that. And eventually Trent would, because of the French Indian War, Trent wanted to be reimbursed for not only the supplies, but also the lands that he would lose because the French taking over that Ohio Valley. And by doing so, he wasn't alone. There were numerous other traders. And eventually they'd be nicknamed the suffering traders because they were all these losses and financial, you know, especially, financial ruin. And Trent would end up being the power of attorney. They would designate him actually to represent all these traders. And he actually went over to England, sailed to England there in April of 1769 and would join. Actually, I have letters of him joining forces with Benjamin Franklin, who, had, of course, had a house there on Craven Street in London. And eventually, there would be numerous letters where Franklin and Trent would dine together, and they joined together a force called initially called the Grand Ohio Company, sort of a group of all these land owners and such to sort of represent. And Trent would eventually present himself to the king's court and sort of, you know, veer at this time to try to get these lands back and, you know, sort of get all these debts that were needed to be owed, especially from the French and Indian War. And not only that, but from Pontiac's rebellion that happened with the Indians attacking the numerous settlements and forts. So by that point, Trent was just trying to get back the money he was rightfully owed, and in trying to get so not only for himself, but also for the rest of the traders. And eventually he would succeed in getting the, for what he called it, the permission to finally, you know, get his land back. But basically they decided to start, and they were in proposals to start a 14th colony, believe it or not.
Wow.
Called Vandalia.
Wow.
And is what he named it in honor of the King George III's wife, Charlotte, who was of Vandalic or like Nordic type descent. And right. They were going to name it Vandalia. They actually were going to have the capital in Pittsburgh. I actually have a letter. One of his landowners, Samuel Wharton, was going to be the governor, elected governor, and he actually had plans in his letter of what the mansion was going to look like in Pittsburgh.
Incredible.
When it was eventually built and they got the permission. But unfortunately, there was a very unfortunate event that was taking place at the same exact time to claim this, and that was, it was sort of ill timing on Trent's part, but the American Revolution broke out.
A lot of fascinating local history
right.
here. By the way, Jason was just on PCN, the Pennsylvania Cable Network, talking about your book, right?
Right, yeah. I was able to sit down with Brian Lockman, the CEO of PCN, and we were talking about the book on a show called PA Books, and we talked for, it was an hour interview about the in-depth of my research and also what I was able to find about not only, you know, the Pittsburgh area, but, you know, Trent's fort there, what they called Fort St. George, and not only that, but William Trent himself.
Yeah. The title of Jason Cherry's book is Pittsburgh's Lost Outpost, Captain Trent's Fort. By the way, a beautiful painting on the cover of Native American Indians pulling up in their canoes at what we now know as the Point, the Forks of the Ohio. That's a beautiful painting, Jason.
Yeah, like I said, it's our colleague and friend of ours, Robert Griffin, you know, fantastic, you know, frontier artist. It was always known for the Eastern Indians and numerous, especially in this area, but throughout. But Robert Griffin was amazing. In fact, he didn't release this print, but it was called Trent and Half King at the Forks, the name of the Indian that was with Trent there at the building of the fort. And he had not released this print, but was, you know, more than happy to, you know, help me aid in telling the story of William Trent and his role there in Pittsburgh.
Jason Cherry, the author of the book. He's a local man, a historian, author, reenactor. And his book is now available, just published this past March. Jason, nice to talk with you again. Thanks for spending time with us here today.
Good to talk to you.
Sure. We'll talk again sometime.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So long. What a nice man, Jason Cherry. We'll take a break. Our next guest will be joining us. We're going to be talking about boating safety with Ray Nagy of the United States Coast Guard Auxiliary. It's coming up here on It's Your Turn in just a moment or so. Osterling's Lawn and Garden should be your first stop this month for any gardening needs. They've got vegetable seeds, herb plants, and plenty of red, white, and gold planting potatoes. If you're looking for some fresh fruit plant options, come see their selection of blueberries, raspberries, and grapes. And remember, this month only, they've got a 50% off sale on Dorvet fly masks and Vanapro fly wipes that'll help keep those pesky flies away. Remember, you can find just about everything you need at Osterling's Lawn and Garden Center in Butler, corner of East Jefferson and Monroe Streets, Osterlings.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening, every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
In 2019, Tri-Rivers celebrates 25 years as your Butler neighbor, providing exceptional musculoskeletal care in the community.
I'm Dr. Scott Rainey, an orthopedic back and neck surgeon at Tri-Rivers. Whether I'm in the office treating patients for conditions such as cervical or lumbar stenosis, or in the operating room performing innovative procedures like disc replacements, I'm proud to care for patients in the Butler community. To learn more or to schedule an appointment, visit TriRiversMSK.com or call 1-866-874-7483.
Welcome back, good friends. Boy, I'm looking forward to chatting with Ray Nagy and with the United States Coast Guard Auxiliary. Actually, Ray and I talked quite a few years ago. I don't remember when, but it was a while back, wasn't it?
Yes, probably two or three years, Dave. Yeah.
Well, Ray is with the United States Coast Guard Auxiliary, Division 7, and we want to talk, among other things, about safe boating as we head into the summer season. In fact, I think last week was the National Safe Boating Week, Ray?
Yes, last week was Safe Boating Week, and we had a proclamation from the Butler County Commissioners. Kim Gower is very, she's a boater, and she's very interested in Safe Boating Week, and it was May 14th to the 24th.
Well, it's still okay for us to talk about it because a lot of folks will be going out on the rivers and the lakes over the next few months during the warm weather season in their boats. Is that one of the prime missions of the U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary, safe boating?
Yes, it is. That and the wearing of the life jackets, and to have the life jackets on board, and more importantly, wear them according to the regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Certain, you know, if you're under a certain age, a certain length boat, you have to wear it.
It's mandatory.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission, of course, enforced that with their, what used to be called game wardens, now they're called conservation officers, CO for short, and they do aggressively enforce it on Lake Moraine.
Is the Coast Guard, not the auxiliary, but the Coast Guard, is that considered a branch of the military services of the U.S.?
No, it is not. I was a veteran probably 50 years ago, and at that time we were under the Department of Transportation, and then before that it was the Department of Treasury when I joined in 1956. Right now it's under the Department of Homeland Security.
Oh, okay.
And we do work with the Navy, for example, who of course is Defense Department. Anytime you hear of a drug interdiction on the ocean down around Florida or Texas or anywhere really where it's a Navy vessel involved, there are Coast Guard officers and petty officers aboard, because the Navy is not law enforcement. The Coast Guard is law enforcement.
I guess now that you mention that, I've seen that portrayed in movies and on TV shows where, you know, a Coast Guard cutter is coming up alongside what appears to be a suspicious boat or a suspicious ship. So they're involved with the law enforcement angle.
Yes, that's true. Now, we in the Coast Guard Auxiliary, we do everything they do except law enforcement and military action, of course. So mm-hmm. we contribute mostly our man hours to them. We contributed over 3 million man hours last year to the Coast Guard. Of course, that helps their budget, which is usually pretty skinny. Of all the armed forces, they have a pretty small budget.
The history of the United States Coast Guard Auxiliary goes back quite a ways, though. I guess it's like 80 years or something like that?
Yes, we just celebrate. This will be our 80th year. That's true. Hmm. You're well read.
Well, I did a little bit of background work, so I don't appear too stupid when I'm chatting with you here today.
Okay.
I did know it was the 80th year for the Coast Guard Auxiliary.
Yes, that is correct.
How big is it? How many
well,
people do you have in the Coast Guard Auxiliary?
We're about as big as the Coast Guard as far as the numbers are concerned. That's I couldn't give it to you off the top of my head. You asked that question a few years ago, and I had an answer for you. This year, I don't have an answer for you. The Butler Flotilla here, we have over 20 members, probably 10 to 12 very active members. And, of course, our main concern is safe boating on Lake Arthur out at Moraine State Park.
You mentioned the Butler Flotilla. That's one of the divisions. And then there are, there are divisions, right,
yes,
too, and regions across the country?
Yeah. We're in the Coast Guard right now, the Ohio Valley sector, which covers all the rivers. The Great Lakes are Coast Guard District number 9. This is Coast Guard. The rivers are Coast Guard District number 8. And Pittsburgh is part of that. And we fall under Pittsburgh. There are 5 flotillas in under Pittsburgh. So there's up here in Butler, we have McKeesport and 2 in Pittsburgh. That's the way it's broken down.
So your aim is to educate people as to the dangers of going without proper life preservers when you're out on the water?
Yes, that's true. It's a real challenge because lately there are more kayakers and canoers, and paddleboards is the latest threat out there as far as life is concerned. A lot of those people, they're buying the low end of the market, and they don't take the trouble to study and find out what is required. The big thing is wear the life jacket. Have the life jacket with you, but better than that, wear it.
I just saw a story about paddle boarders a couple of days ago, which I was amazed. There are three guys, I think, 2 or 3, who are planning to paddleboard across Lake Erie. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I saw something in a newspaper about that. That ought to be a pretty good adventure, but they're probably being escorted by a powerboat, I would think.
I can't, because when you're on a paddleboard, you're standing up. It's like you're standing on a surfboard with a paddle. And the whole way across Lake Erie, it's fantastic. I can't believe it.
That's true. You can also kneel on that, and some paddles are adjustable. Of course, you have a different length paddle from when you're standing and when you're kneeling.
But you could fall off. Lake Erie has big waves.
Yes, I mean, it's it's a risk, and the same thing with the kayaks. It's the low end of boating because you can get into it relatively under $500, and you should take the time and the effort to study it a little bit and find out what the hazards are. And the big thing is wear the life jacket.
Mm-hmm. I have noticed in the past several years more and more of the discount department stores, sporting goods stores, displaying kayaks, you know, a lot of them.
Yeah, that's true. And it's there are more deaths recently from kayaks and the low end of the market as opposed to the high end of the market. We used to talk about drinking and boating and being a hazard, and it still is. But recently, most of the deaths have been from small boats, kayaks and paddleboards and canoes.
I'm guessing that kayaks are easily tipped, just as canoes are. They can tip over in the water.
Yes, that's true. The good kayakers, if you take a lesson from someone that sells you the kayak, they teach you how to turn it over and recover. And it's, of course, you got to hold your breath. You don't want to be breathing. That first breath is, if it's water, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, the life jacket brings you up. Some people think they can put the life jacket on in the water. If you ever try to do that, it's very difficult. It's difficult for a young person, and it's very difficult for us elderly folks.
I've never been in a kayak. I've done canoeing, and I know you have to be very careful there, particularly if you're changing seats with someone or whatever. It's very easy to tip it. And when I look at kayakers, I think that's going to be even easier to tip that over. So actually, part of the training is to tip it over on purpose to teach you how to recover from it.
Yes, they do. They try to go all the way around when they're training them. Mm. And, of course, you can't be afraid of the water, and you do have to hold your breath until you get all the way around to the other side.
And they seem to use those a lot in white water, right? You know, when they're shooting the rapids.
Yeah, well, those fellows there are the real experts. If they go to different classes of the river to do that, and it's that is a real challenge. And, of course, boating is a lot of fun. So it's not supposed to be unsafe or life-threatening. It's supposed to be a good time. But every year, about 700 people die in the boating-related accidents.
Wow.
That's a lot.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had no idea it was that. That's just the United States? Wow.
Yes, it is. That's the United States. And that's Kim Geyer, your commissioner, did the research on that, and it's stated
here. She added in the resolution.
Proclamation.
Why is it that some people are reluctant to wear a life preserver when they're on a boat? Is it some kind of macho thing or something like that? Why wouldn't they wear one?
There's a little bit of that, but a lot of it, lack of education, because the old ones were cumbersome and uncomfortable. The new ones, there's no reason not to wear them. They have the style that are just go around your neck, and they're not full of styrofoam. They inflate when you hit the water, or you can pull like a ripcord to inflate it, and those are comfortable. And then the kayakers have their own style, which have a large arm opening, so they're not hindered by paddling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the style they should buy, and not the cheap $20 ones at Walmart. You have to spend $50 to get one that's going to be comfortable, and the ones that are self-inflatable, you're looking at about $100. And so it's a matter of economics also.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be similar probably to the ones that are on aircraft, right? Passenger aircraft?
Yes. They're similar. Different, but similar. And there's two styles. One can go around the belt. The problem with the one around the belt, it has a tendency not to keep your head out of the water when you deploy it when you're in the water.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, that goes around your neck and your upper body, that will keep your head out of the water.
Well, that's always part of the pre-flight safety you get, you know, while you're being pushed back and then taxiing down the tarmac, before an airplane flight. I tell you about the under your seat is a life preserver and tell you how to do it and everything.
That's true. Mm-hmm. You know, many years ago, Dave, that the first transcontinental flight from San Francisco to Hawaii was a Pan Am Clipper that went down out in the water, and they were rescued by a U.S. Coast Guard cutter that was out on ocean patrol. Mm. And back then, everybody thanked them, thinking it was the Navy. Well, Kennedy was president, JFK was president. Being an ex-Navy man, he felt this rescue should belong to the Coast Guard, as it was a Coast Guard ship. He's the one to come up with the idea of putting the orange stripe on a Coast Guard vessel as opposed to battleship gray like the Navy ships have. So the next time something of that would happen, he felt the Coast Guard would get the credit because of the blaze orange stripe.
How about that?
And to this day, all the Coast Guard craft and some of the offices and the stations have an orange stripe as a recognition symbol.
I have seen some of the newer life preservers, life jackets, whatever you want to call them, that are much slimmer. If you're thinking of those bulky orange canvas type things of years gone by, that's like your father's Oldsmobile, I guess, right?
That's exactly right. And calling it a life jacket, also the latest terminology is PFD, personal flotation device. PFD.
I'll try to be correct on that. Personal flotation
device. That
wasn't
a correction.
Well, you never know. You don't go out on a boat thinking that you're going to need it, but for heaven's sakes, there was just a story just this week, yesterday, I believe, where a boat overturned on the Danube over in Europe, and I don't know, a number of people dead, 20-some missing, presumed dead.
Well, yeah, it's
this was a sightseeing boat. Who thinks that's going to overturn in the middle of the Danube River?
Right. You would think it'd be pretty safe, and
they
have safety drills. If you've ever cruised, of course, you know that they run you through a safety drill for donning a life vest or a PFD, and I'm sure they did that on the river, but in a time of panic, it's easy to forget what they told you to do.
I've ridden on pontoon craft on Lake Arthur out of Moraine State Park. I don't know whether it was the nautical nature or not. It's been some years ago. But everybody got on board. The first thing we were instructed to do was to look inside the seat. You know, you lifted up the hinge on the seat, and there were all the personal flotation devices in there, and everybody had to put one on.
That's right. That was a good crew that told you to do that, and that's the right way to go.
We'll take a break.
You're safe. You're very safe.
Yeah. We'll take a break. We'll be back and talk about more boating safety as we head into the summer season. We're pleased to have Ray Nagy with us from the United States Coast Guard Auxiliary. Back in just a moment. One of our sponsors on the program today is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. It's that time of the year. Folks are putting in their vegetable plants. Maybe you already have. A lot of folks put them in over Memorial Day weekend. Here's an idea. Why not designate a couple of plants at the end of the row, a couple of tomato plants or beans or whatever you have, and say any produce that I get from these plants goes to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank. They've done this program for many, many years, and it's been tremendously successful. A great help for needy families who, you can imagine their pleasure at getting fresh produce instead of non-perishable items, which is the usual fare at a food bank. Now, a little bit later on, another month and a half, when we start getting in more harvest, they'll announce the details of their weekly pickup. But for now, just think about it. If you haven't put in your tomato plants or your peppers or whatever yet, or if you already have, why not designate a plant or two for the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank? They like to say we stand tallest when we stoop to help others. Back to talk more with Ray Nagy here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
$3. Not too much $3 can buy these days, not even a gallon of gas. Fortunately, with the Butler Transit Authority, $3 provides you with all-day transportation with over 250 local Butler bus stops. Butler Transit can get you to all the major Butler shopping destinations, medical facilities, downtown, and much more. Visit our downtown bus terminal on West Newcastle Street or on the web at butlertransit.com.
Summer foods have arrived at Michael's Restaurant, just in time for your trip to picnic at Moraine or for dinner after a day at the park. Michael's is a great place to celebrate with a graduation dinner or hold a party in their private room. And Jeep Fest time is almost here, so Michael's Restaurant will have great Jeep specials for all the Jeepers who arrive in Butler.
Welcome back. We're chatting with Ray Nagy from the United States Coast Guard Auxiliary, the Butler Flotilla. You were telling me during the break, Ray, about a film you saw a few months ago about a Coast Guard rescue, The Finest Hours. That's the name of the film?
Yes, it is. It was on the East Coast out of a lifeboat station out of Connecticut, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it was a successful rescue attempt?
Well, two freighters broke up. In fact, as they broke right in half, they were able to get almost everybody off of the one. I believe they lost one crew member that couldn't make it from the wreck ship to the 36-foot lifeboat. It was a very heavy sea running, and these fellas that pulled this off as a four-man crew from the Coast Guard lifeboat station, and that lifeboat's 36-foot long with a 6-cylinder gas inboard engine designed to hold about 12 people. They had 31 people on that boat, including the crew.
Wow.
No, 36, including the crew. So it was quite the story. It's a good movie. Hollywood did a good job on it. Usually they mess it up, but that one came out pretty good.
You say you saw it about 6 months ago?
Yes.
Might be available on DVD now.
I'll have to check. Yeah. I'd like to see it again.
Finest Hours, the true story of the U.S. Coast Guard's most daring rescue at sea. Major motion picture. Does the Coast Guard Auxiliary promote other aspects of safe boating? For example, I've talked with the law enforcement, and they say they're seeing more and more instances of boating under the influence, you know, people that are drinking and then boating out on the rivers or the lakes.
Yeah, well, we support the training. There are boat courses available from us, from the Power Squadron, and also from the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission, and there are courses also online. And boating under the influence is 0.8, similar to driving, if you're caught. At that range, they can take you right off the water, put you in handcuffs. You can drink on the water, but you cannot be intoxicated on the water.
Mm-hmm. So, same as in a vehicle, I guess.
Huh? Yeah, it's although in a vehicle, I don't believe you can have an open bottle.
No, that's a violation as well.
On the boat, you can have an open bottle. We encourage people to wait till you get back. If you're going to drink, and beer goes good with water, wait till you get back to the dock, you know, and have your first beer.
Are there regulations when I'm not a boater, so it might seem like a silly question. Are there regulations about how you pass another boat? If there's somebody coming towards you, do you have to pass on one side or the other?
Oh, absolutely. We have rules of the road, and of course there are no red lights or green lights out there, but normally you would pass on the right just as you would in a vehicle. You can pass on the left, and you're supposed to indicate by your horn or whistle on whether you're passing another boat to the left or the starboard or port. So, yes, there are rules.
What about the lights on a boat? Even I've seen when I'm out at Lake Arthur in the evening, you see different colored lights on a boat. What's that all about?
Yeah, you have running lights. So you have the bow lights are green and red. You got the green is on the starboard side, and the red's on the port side. That'd be your left side. You also have a white, what they call an all-around light. It's supposed to be on the highest point of your boat, So you have, if you're under power and moving, you should have three lights that are visible.
So the red and the green, that way you're able to tell at a distance whether a boat's coming toward you or going the other direction?
That's exactly right. And depending on what side they're on, you can tell that, and you can tell whether they're coming towards you or going away from you in the dark. Absolutely.
Do you have to be a certain age to operate a boat on waterways in Pennsylvania?
Depends on the horsepower. This anything under, I believe it's 20 or 25 horse, anybody can operate. Now, you should have a boating certificate, either from us or the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission. Above 25 horsepower, you have to have a certificate, and 12 years old, you cannot drive a higher horsepower boat.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and
yes,
there are many places.
There are restrictions.
Many places, including Lake Arthur, by the way, where there are horsepower restrictions.
You can't use
really high-powered outboards.
Yeah.
Talking with Ray Nagy from the United States Coast Guard Auxiliary. Boats have to be licensed, don't they, just like vehicles, just like cars?
Yes, they do, and that's done by the state. If you live in Pennsylvania, you have to have a Pennsylvania sticker on there. It's the beginning of your boat number. It'd be PA, then dash, a four-digit number, and then a suffix after that, depending on what part of the year you bought it in. And you have to pay for it, of course. It's like a license on a car.
Canoes and kayaks, too, or just other boats?
Yes, anything powered would have
to have that.
And canoes and kayaks can have a number. It's an option. But if they're not powered and you don't have to have a number, you do have to have a launch permit. So you have to get a launch permit from either, if you're on Lake Arthur, you have to get it out there, or if you're on the Army Corps of Engineer Lake, you have to get a launch permit from them. So you just can't put a boat in the water and think you're home free.
You mentioned a certificate from you. How do people get that?
Well, we teach boating courses a couple times a year, both at our facility, which we meet the first Wednesday of the month at Butler Airport. We're in the pilot's lounge at the lower level, and we do teach boating courses periodically. The other flotillas do also. The one in McKeesport probably teach three or four per year, and Pittsburgh, of course, has boating courses. And like I said earlier, the Pennsylvania Boat Commission has them, and they also have them online. So you can go online and take it also.
Hmm. Ray Nagy from the United States Coast Guard Auxiliary. You've been in the auxiliary for a long time. You were in the Coast Guard originally.
Yeah, well, yeah, I was in the Coast Guard for 4 years back in 56 through 1960, and I've been in the auxiliary 11 years. It's just been the recent 11 years. I was reluctant to join for a while, and working and raising a family. And I got talked into it by some of my fellow shipmates that said, you got to join the auxiliary and give back some of your so-called knowledge that you learned.
Well, it's great fun to be out on the water. A lot of folks do it. A lot of folks like to have gatherings with friends, on the water, picnics out at the lake, and then you head out on the water, whatever. Your message is, hey, enjoy yourself, but just be safe.
That's exactly right. Boating is supposed to be fun, and it is fun, but you do have to be safe. And we encourage you to take the courses that are available so you know what to do and what not to do. And enjoy yourself, but be safe.
Good to see you again, Ray.
Good. Thank you for the opportunity, Dave. And Butler Radio has been very instrumental in recruiting for us. Our last two applicants that we've had come on board was a result of hearing you on Butler Radio. I'd like to thank you for that.
So you would welcome more applicants to join the U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary?
Absolutely. We need, we've lost some people due to passing away, what we call in the Naval Services, passing over to bar, you're gone. And we also had a couple transfers. The Coast Guard being a national organization, if you move, you can transfer to another state. Mm-hmm. We've had a couple of those happen. And so, yeah, we're always looking for new members. And some of us are getting a little older. We'd like to encourage some younger fellows to come on, some veterans. We encourage your veterans to join. We could use the help.
United States Coast Guard Auxiliary, Butler Flotilla. Ray Nagy chatting with us. Program note, we have Pirate baseball again tonight. Here on WISR, the Pirates right back home after the series in Cincinnati. They start a four-game series with Milwaukee tonight. Airtime for WISR. Pirate warm-up, 6:40 tonight. I'm Dave Malarkey. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday. We'll see you tomorrow, 12:30, on It's Your Turn here on WISR.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.
See how much I